abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, March 17th, 2014. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all you guys. I'm talking about the Austrian business cycle theory today. What causes boom and bust in the economy? And I know a lot of you listeners are longtime students of Austrian economics, but not everybody. And some folks are just getting into this for the first time. And so I thought this is a topic that we all need to know about. And it's a topic that even if you're an advanced student, you can always deepen your understanding of it. What is it that makes the economy go up and down, as we've seen time and again? Is this an inherent feature of the market economy, as Karl Marx believed, or is there something else going on? That's what we're going to talk about today with Dave Howden. Before we get to Dave, I want to thank you guys once again for helping me pay the bills here and helping me keep my little Tom Woods Show office where I'm able to make these programs for you guys in peace and quiet. You can help me out at no cost to yourself when you're about to make an Amazon purchase. Just head over to TomWoodsRadio.com and enter Amazon from there, and you will help me pay those bills. Just think to yourself when you're about to buy something from Amazon, isn't there some guy who keeps badgering me about something I'm supposed to do when I'm ordering from Amazon? And this guy gives me a free show, right, all the time. No matter what's going on in his family life, he's still giving me a free show. Who is that guy? And then you'll say, aha, TomWoodsRadio.com, and that would really be helpful. All right, let's talk now to Dave Howden. You guys may not know David Howden, but this is going to be another one of these people who's fantastic, whom you hear about for the first time on the Tom Woods Show, and you say, wow, I'm so glad to know there's another great guy I didn't know about. Well, that's what I'm trying to do more or less every single day. Like you tune in, you say, I can't believe there's another great guy. I thought we had like half a dozen great guys. And turns out we got a whole bunch of great people involved in this. Well, David Howden is the chair of the Department of Business and Economics and a professor of economics at St. Louis University on the Madrid campus. He is academic vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute of Canada, where he is also the editor of the Journal of Prices and Markets. He's the author of Institutions in Crisis, European Perspectives on the Recession, and with Philip Baggus, Deep Freeze, Iceland's Economic Collapse. One other interesting thing about Dave is he read the tremendous book, huge book, by Jesus Huerta de Soto called Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles, and was completely convinced of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So he learned Spanish so he could fly to Spain and stay in Spain for a doctoral program under Jesus Huerta de Soto. He said, I got to study with this guy, so first I've got to learn Spanish, and then I'll go get my PhD under this guy. That's the caliber of person we're welcoming to the program right now. So Dave Howden, thanks again for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
All right. I thought of you when I thought I wanted to have a program explaining Austrian business cycle theory to the layman, because I think you're just so good at explaining things. I like good explainers. And also, I mean, I can do this too, but I have some questions that I want to get answered. So I thought, well, you know, let's ask Dave Howden. What are friends for, after all? So that's why.
Okay.
All right. So before.
Hope I don't disappoint.
No, you won't. You won't. All right. Now, before we get started, give us sort of a 2-minute basic overview. No nuance, just the absolute basics, vastly oversimplifying it, of Austrian business cycle theory, so that then when we go through point by point, people will already have the bird's eye view, so they'll understand more or less how the whole thing is going to go.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, actually, before I explain, give you the bird's eye view of what it is, I'll tell you what it's not, because most people who have heard about Austrian business cycle theory commonly associate it with something that it's not.
Okay.
So one story is typically that the Federal Reserve or the central bank holds interest rates too low for too long, and this makes borrowing very cheap or relatively cheap compared to what it otherwise would be. So business people and consumers and entrepreneurs rush out and they go on a borrowing binge and load up with debt, and then they buy too many houses and make too many investments and buy too many cars and consumers' goods and things like this. So most people associate Austrian business cycle theory erroneously as a theory of people loading up with debt and then just buying too many goods, making too many investments, over-consuming and over-investing, in other words. And the reason why I want to start it out this way in explaining it is because this is how Austrian business cycle theory commonly gets sold by people who don't know what it is. So to give you the correct rendition, it starts out the same. The Federal Reserve sets interest rates too low for too long and makes credit too easy for people. But it's not really a theory of too much investment going on. It's a theory of the wrong types of investment going on. And by this, what we mean is that entrepreneurs and business people, when they invest money, they have to do it for a certain amount of time. And that time period during which they invest is the time period in which the investment matures and then starts creating something that consumers can purchase. And when interest rates are dropped artificially low, it motivates investors to start pursuing really, really, really long-dated investment projects, too long, really. These are investment projects that aren't going to mature or won't create anything for an extended period of time. And this waiting period is just too long for people to wait and too long for companies to keep going without actually having a saleable good that will create cash flow for them. So the crux of the problem is businesses make these long-dated investments that don't pay off for a long period of time, and then it turns out to be too long, so they don't have any cash flow that comes in a timely manner, and they start becoming illiquid and then eventually bankrupt.
Dave, Roger Garrison sometimes says that in order to understand how things go wrong, it's sometimes useful to try to understand how they can go right. And maybe it might be a good idea to start off our full-fledged discussion by describing how the economy functions without this extraneous intervention. How would things work smoothly? What would things look like, imagining we had a free market economy and interest rates were set just through the voluntary actions of many millions of people and there's no central authority doing it? What would things look like in that case? And then let's unpack what they would look like with the intervention.
Oh, okay. Well, here's a nice story to put in your mind to set the stage. Imagine that you are Robinson Crusoe, shipwrecked on a desert island with nothing really to speak of, no tools, no nothing. And you wake up in the morning and you realize, oh, I've got to go and do something, find some food in order to stay alive. So you find a tree that has berries on it, and you start picking the berries off. And you can pick enough berries to keep yourself alive, but you don't have a very luxurious life. So soon enough, you're going to start asking yourself the question, well, how can I get ahead in this life? It's not very fun living hand-to-mouth, literally in this case. So how can I do something to improve my quality of life? And the answer to that lies in increasing your productivity, making yourself a better berry picker. The way you become a better berry picker is by investing. In this case, Robinson Crusoe on the desert island is going to have to come up with some type of investment which will make him more productive at picking berries. And just to think about a simple example, this could be an investment in taking some time away from picking berries and searching for a stick or searching for a better bush to pick berries from or something of that nature. But the only problem is, right now, he needs to pick berries continually in order to eat, to have enough to eat to stay alive. And the prerequisite for him taking time off from picking these berries is going to be that he needs to save some of the berries as he's picking them and not consume them right away, so that then when he takes time off from picking berries to search for a stick to help him take the berries off the tree better, he'll have something, a stockpile of berries with which to eat to keep him alive during this process. And now to make it a little bit more modern, the berries in this example are like savings. He produced something in the past, and he needed to save it up, and those savings needed to sustain him while he pursued some kind of production process, quote-unquote. The production process in this case is very simple. It's just searching around looking for a tool to help him be a better berry picker. But the point that you can draw from this is that savings are a prerequisite to successfully completing an investment project. If he didn't have a sufficient amount of berries to keep him alive while he went out searching for a stick, and he needed too much time in order to find a stick, and he didn't have enough berries to keep himself alive, he would have to abandon that investment project and go back to picking berries to stay alive. So if he doesn't have enough berries stockpiled beforehand, he will not have the sufficient means to successfully pursue the investment project after the fact. Savings is a necessary prerequisite for investment. Now, then if you put this story together and make it a little bit more elaborate in the modern economy, you would think, well, savings is money and loans, and savings is also not consuming, just like it is for Robinson Crusoe. His savings are berries that he hasn't consumed at a prior time. Savings today is having workers produce things and then saying, I'm not going to consume them right away. I'm going to produce this car. I'm not going to use it right away. I'm going to produce this food, but not eat it right away, so on and so forth. And we need this savings in order to sustain us later on, while the economy as a whole, as just an abstract concept, pursues these long-dated investment projects. And that's how things go right, first of all. Things go right. The investment is successful when savings match the investment or are sufficient to complete the investment you partake on. Now, when things go wrong, you could ask yourself, how would things go wrong? It's pretty hard to see how things would go wrong in Robinson Crusoe's scenario, right? He picks berries and he takes time off and searches for a stick to be a better berry picker. There's not much room for error there. But in the modern economy, where savings is defined as money and money that you're going to loan to entrepreneurs and businessmen, you could think of lots of room for error. And the place where the error comes from is through the very process of creating money. That is, the central bank controls the money supply. So in the modern economy, savings is you and I not spending all of our paycheck and loaning it out to entrepreneurs to invest. But it's also the central bank just creating money out of thin air and then letting entrepreneurs have access to this money created out of thin air to complete their investment project. And it seems like it wouldn't be such a problem. I mean, we're just creating money out of thin air, so what could possibly go wrong? But it goes wrong because it gets these entrepreneurs to start investing in new types of investment projects. These are the ones, like I said, that are too much for the available of real savings. Investors actually need a real supply of goods that are going into their investment projects, right? We need real physical goods, and we need to have workers available and things like that. But the fact that the central bank creates money out of thin air and in the process drives down interest rates low, it causes investors to start taking on these really long-dated investment projects, and as they start maturing at the same time, they start putting an extreme drain on the system. They need more goods which should have been saved in order to complete them. And it's this drain on the system that happens as they start progressing and becoming more mature that causes the economy to grind to a halt. There's just not enough workers available or the right types of workers to complete the investment projects. There's not enough oil to support all of the investment projects. There are not enough cars or trucks to distribute all of the goods that were supposed to be produced. And that's really what is going wrong.
The way I've described it, now, by the way, I love that explanation. And I think it is very much in line with what I've been saying, which makes me relieved. As a non-economist, I'm glad to know I haven't been selling snake oil to people. But one of the ways I try to explain to people is more or less as follows, that what's going on without the Fed's intervention is that you have a smooth kind of transition. When the general public decides indeed to save more, well, then consumer goods industries, the lower order stages of production, find that, well, relatively speaking, there isn't as much demand for their product, so they will relatively shrink, and thereby resources will be released for the so-called higher order stages, the longer term stages of production. So now there's more lumber for those higher order stages to use, more trucking services, different types of labor are available. And so while certain parts of the economy contract, relatively speaking, other parts expand. But when the central bank is involved, both are trying to expand at once. People continue to want consumer goods just as they did before, if not more. But now you've got a tug of war going on, because now instead of a smooth transition from parts of the economy to other parts of the economy, you've got these higher order stages, these longer term investment projects going on that need the resources, that and they're not available now because they haven't been released by the contraction of other parts of the economy. So these different parts of the economy are in a tug of war with each other instead of a smooth transition from one to the other. And the tug of war winds up bidding up costs above projections, and then you wind up getting bankruptcies. Am I off on any of this?
No, I would say that's pretty accurate. And I would add to that you're right. When it's people naturally and voluntarily saving money and then loaning it to businesses, and businesses changing their production plans to produce more of one type of good when consumer demands change, or to pursue a different production process to produce a different type of good, it is this fluid, gradual process. People's preferences don't change overnight. Our savings don't jump around in a very volatile manner, right? It's this smooth, continuous process, and consumers and producers, they're linked in this. They're linked directly because the savings from consumers choosing not to consume is what's funding businesses and their production plans. So we get a consistent, a cohesive economy. And then when the central bank all of a sudden jumps in, it's like you get this third party with no relation to either consumers or producers. And they start tinkering around with a very blunt object or a very blunt tool. And the tool that they use is the core interest rate, right? The federal funds rate in the States. And by lowering that, they're very abruptly changing a whole dynamic on the side of consumers and their demands to save money versus consume, and on producers when they're drafting their plans to produce many goods versus few goods, or to produce consumers' goods versus investment goods, or something of that nature. So the central bank, by getting in the middle of this, they're almost, well, first of all, they're bound to fail, but before they even fail, they're bound to be disruptive, just because they are fiddling away with a very finely tuned economy, which is naturally linked together and naturally functioning fine, but they're fiddling around with it with this very blunt tool that's just completely disconnecting the consumers and the producers of the economy away from one another.
Now, the way you're describing it, and the way I think it's classically described, the Austrian business cycle theory is describing a situation that is self-reversing, that has got to come to an end. If the economy is, in effect, being expected to do something that is impossible, then it has to stop doing it at some point, it has to stop trying. But it seems to me that the way that these booms come to an end is not that the internal logic of Austrian business cycle theory brings them to an end. It's that the central bank simply stops pumping money in. It simply stops pushing interest rates down, and that leads the thing to collapse. But isn't there something to the logic of the theory that says that even if the central bank just kept on doing it and kept on doing it, if the resources aren't there, physical resources aren't there to fund these investments, then they can't be completed?
Yeah, well, here's an example. Pick a country and pick a central bank that doesn't stop printing money at the boom's end. I don't know, what are some examples? Zimbabwe, maybe. There's an example of just continuing to print money as the boom keeps going to try to stop it from ending, and we see how that ends, right? In complete destruction of the economy. Here's why it necessarily must come to an end. Why it couldn't keep going forever. And I like your analogy here of a tug of war. So think about the tug of war that's going on in the economy right now. On the one hand, with really low interest rates, what are consumers motivated to do? And the easy answer is consume, not save, right? Nobody wants to save any money if they're not making any interest or if they're not going to make any money from it. So consumers consume. That's pretty simple, and I think that's pretty evident in the most recent boom-bust cycle. And then if you look on the producer side of things with really low interest rates, what are they motivated to do? And they are motivated to do two things. On the one hand, they want to make money off consumers consuming. So it makes sense that producers are going to start building a bunch of retail stores, a bunch of commercial investments that are going to be very heavily tilted towards satisfying the consumer experience. So that's retail stores, that's malls, that is anything that's directly related to selling these final products. And then on the other hand, if they're looking at interest rates and they're trying to figure out, well, how long should our investment projects be? Should we be doing very long-dated investment projects that will be very nice once they complete, but gosh, they take forever to get to completion, and that's necessary because that's when the cash flow is going to come in from them. That's going to bring us to profitability. And when interest rates drop, all of a sudden entrepreneurs have a real incentive to start producing longer and longer dated investment projects. They, in essence, they're willing to wait a longer period of time for their cash flows to come in from a finished product, induced by these low interest rates. And the tug of war that develops is as follows. If you think about the economy as a whole, as a temporal sequence, extending out from the moment when a consumer buys a finished product all the way back in time to when that product started being designed, when the research and development went into it, or when the mines started digging into the ground to get the ore out and things like that, which could be many years previous to when the final good is actually produced. Where do you see the investment taking place? You see it right at the moment when the consumer buys the consumer's good, because there's so much demand on the side of consumers to buy, that you should see all sorts of stores springing up, malls everywhere, things of this nature. And then businesses, where are they making their investments? They're making them way back early in the production process. R&D, mining, getting natural resources out of the ground, all of these things that will pay off someday, but it's going to take a long time. And where do you not see investment taking place? Nobody is making investment in the middle of these two extremes. And the middle is like infrastructure investment. It's not sexy. It's not incredibly long dated, right? Building a road, it doesn't take that long until, or not building a road rather, but maintaining a road. It doesn't take that long to pay off, but it doesn't pay off instantaneously like producing a new store or a new mall will. So you see a total lack of investment in the medium stages of production, and that's what the tug of war is. The end that's biased towards consumers, that does really well and that expands. The end which is biased as far away from as possible from consumers, like research and development, that does really well. But everything in the middle, there's no investment going on. So you should see your infrastructure completely crumbling. Nobody wants to spend money on this, because that is the least profitable of all the investment projects during the boom that you could be diverting your money to.
Can you flesh that out a little bit more, though? Because when people think infrastructure, they think, well, those expenditures are politically driven anyway, so entrepreneurs wouldn't be engaged in that. What other types of spending could you have in mind in terms of the middle stages?
Oh, well, a big one in middle stages is businesses taking care of the depreciation allowance for their capital investment. So machinery needs to be, your business needs to be a well-oiled machine, to use an analogy. It needs to be maintained every single year. You need to have technicians taking a look at you need to have technicians and mechanics and all sorts of people come in to maintain your capital stock. But these are the types of investments that businesses don't want to do during the boom either, right? They want to spend money on let's look at Walmart. Walmart wants to spend money building new physical stores to satisfy the demands of consumers during the boom. Walmart wants to spend money designing better software to help them, to help on the logistics side of things and to help on the distribution side of things, because low interest rates are enticing them to make long-dated investments. designing a new piece of logistics software, if you're Walmart, is not going to pay off for a long period of time, right? It's something that will be nice someday, but in the meantime, it's just a lot of spending, which is not going to create a sudden cash flow. But Walmart is enticed, is motivated to do this type of investment because the interest rate is so low. It makes sense to do really long-dated investment projects. But what Walmart is not going to be investing very much in during the boom is just maintaining its facilities, is the very basics of filling in the cracks in the sidewalks or maintaining the asphalt in front of the store or replacing the light bulbs in the store when they burn out. Those are facetious examples. But what I mean to say is it's the medium-stage investments that don't really classify as immediately satisfying consumer goods or consumer wants and are also not incredibly long-dated like research and investment. Those are the things that businesses start to neglect, oiling the machines and getting technicians in to maintain them. They just let them depreciate because investing money in those things is relatively unprofitable during the boom. And by relative, I mean relative to satisfying consumer wants on the one end of the scale or investing in really long-dated investment projects on the other end of the scale.
Dave, I have two more questions I want to ask, and I know I'm already kind of over the time I said I would take from you, but I hope I can ask them both. Because if I ask just the first one, I'm going to be disappointed, because the first one is so common, but I feel like we have to ask it. The expectations question, why don't businesses learn? Why don't they learn to factor in a Federal Reserve premium into their expectations of how much these projects are going to wind up costing them, that costs are going to rise unexpectedly because it's going to turn out that they're actually going to be competing for resources, the competition for resources is going to bid prices up. Like, why don't they say, look, we've been burned before, the Fed gets involved, it looks like a big boom, we engage in these long-term investment projects, and it always comes back to bite us. This time, why don't we proceed cautiously, or why don't we at least factor in the possibility that this project that we're going to engage on might wind up being 30% more expensive than we expect? Like, why are they so stupid is maybe the most common free market sort of objection. I mean, there are other objections that Keynesians might have, but this is maybe the most common objection that people who otherwise might like the free market would have to the Austrian view specifically.
I would give you two reasons. The first one is, consider the business person. He is not concerned exclusively with absolute profits, with just making money and avoiding losses. If that was his only concern, then you'd say, okay, I recognize there's an Austrian business cycle going on right now. It's not going to last, so I'm just going to sit this one out, right? I'll let all my competitors take part. They'll all be bankrupted at the end of this whole thing, and I'll take a couple of years off, and then I'll, once the dust settles, then I'll open up my store again and get back into it. Business people just can't sit it out. You're not concerned only with absolute profits, but you need to have relative profits. You need to always compete against your competitors. Otherwise, they drive you out of business. So a business person can't possibly just say, I know what's going on, but I'm not going to take part in this. You have to take part. Otherwise, you get left in the dust by your competitors, at least while this artificial boom is still going on.
So in other words, because your competitors are getting the benefits of being able to engage in investment very, very cheaply, and you're just sitting on the sidelines?
Exactly. And they're earning profits, at least in the short run, during the boom, when everything is still okay. Your competitors are pulling ahead of you, right? If you sit it out. So you're not really at liberty to just sit it out because you think it's an unsustainable boom. But here's maybe the key point in this. The Austrian business cycle, and this is my second reason, the Austrian business cycle as a theory is a qualitative theory. It says that the artificial boom will inevitably have to come to an end. It doesn't say anything quantitative, so it doesn't say how long the boom is going to last for. And business people, they don't know how long this boom is going to last for either. So to say, okay, we're in the midst of an artificial boom, I'm just going to sit this one out. The business person has no idea whether the boom is going to last or keep on going for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, a decade, whatever have you. So to say, okay, we'll close up shop and we're going to stay away from this artificial boom that's going to end badly, and we're going to do so indefinitely because we can't really say ahead of time how long this is going to keep going for, how long this game is going to keep getting played for. Businesses just can't sit it out like that. They need to keep They need to stay in business to keep competing against their competitors and hope for the best. So it's almost like they're forced to participate in the boom. Otherwise, their competitors pull ahead, and then you're out of business anyway.
The other question I want to ask you is, would you say that the Austrian theory of the business cycle is the only explanation for business cycles? Like, what would you say to somebody who said, this sounds like a plausible story you're telling here, Howden, but I think there are, you know, five or six other ways that business cycles could be set in motion. Is there anything wrong with a claim like that?
There is and there isn't. There are business cycles that exist for particular reasons. Wars, famines, droughts. Those are typical, very specific reasons why you could have a business cycle. The Austrian business cycle theory is the only one that explains why the economy as a whole is experiencing a general downturn in business conditions. And the reason why the Austrian business cycle theory is the only one capable of doing it is because it's the only business cycle theory which addresses the common denominator that links everything in the economy together, money. Money is the common denominator that defines every single transaction that takes place in the economy. If you want something to generally go wrong, if you want a general downturn that affects all businesses in some way, you need to upset the one thing that links all transactions and businesses together, and that's money. And because money takes such a central starring role in the Austrian business cycle, this is why it's really the only theory that adequately explains why you can have general downturns instead of just industry-specific downturns, right? You can have a new technology that springs up in one part of the economy, and maybe it makes another part of the economy redundant. So that specific area will have a downturn, like the advent of the car caused the horse carriage industry to go into deep recession. But that's very specific. That's industry specific. The Austrian theory says, no, the whole economy is going to experience bouts of booms and busts because it's driven by changes in the money supply or central bank-driven changes in the money supply. And that is going to cause all industries to succumb to this cycle together.
Well, Dave, you've been extremely helpful and a good sport staying a little bit long, but let me just conclude by asking you about the book that you've been putting together with Joe Salerno, kind of a 100-year overview of the record of the Fed with contributions from numerous economists. When can we expect that book, and what's the title going to be?
The title, as long as the publisher doesn't change it, is The Fed at 100. It's the centennial of the Federal Reserve. I don't know if, many people probably are aware of this, although I'm surprised there's not more in the press about it. But after 100 years of existing, the Fed is almost revered in the economy, at least by some people. And it comes from a complete ignorance, I would say, as to what the Fed has actually achieved over the last 100 years. And when you actually look at the track record, you can see that it's actually pretty horrific. So Joe Salerno and I, we've edited a book, and Tom, you have a chapter very graciously written for the book.
Thanks.
And we overview the theory, which is very clear for Austrian economists of why central banks are so damaging and debilitating to the economy. And then we provide many chapters, or we don't provide them. Other authors have thankfully provided them, illustrating the historical examples of where the American economy has been disrupted at the hands of the Fed. So we set the records straight, so to speak, after 100 years of existence.
Well, it sounds great. I can't wait to be able to sink my teeth into it. I'm only familiar with my own contribution, so I don't know. Don't spoil the surprise. I'll see what awaits me when it comes out. But when that is available, I'd like to have you back on, and we'll talk about what's in there.
That would be perfect. I look forward to it, Tom.
All right, Dave, thanks so much for being here again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, everybody, that's Dave Howden. I want to point out to you a page that I have dealing with one of the objections to Austrian business cycle theory, this whole thing of why couldn't they predict that this was going to happen? Why do the businessmen keep falling for this? And that's at libertyclassroom.com/Matt, M-A-T-T, because I initially made that page to respond to Matt Iglesias. But libertyclassroom.com/Matt is a useful resource for you guys, one of my free resource pages that I put up from time to time when I make a video. Let's review what we're going to be covering this week on the program. let's see, tomorrow we're going to talk to Walter Block about the free market and the environment. Then later this week, we'll be getting to the bottom of the whole Common Core controversy, and we'll also be talking to Joel Salatin by popular demand. So great week of programs this week. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. You can do that easily through the links at TomWoodsRadio.com. And we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.